I just wanted to revisit this issue of when a positive portrayal is negative. And the case here is the study that you had to read by Innocent Fagan on The Cosby Show. In The Cosby Show, talking about different views, whether The Cosby Show was a good thing for portraying a counter-stereotypical view of African Americans, or whether it was a bad thing. So does somebody want to summarize for me, 25 words or less, what the positive view is here? The positive view of The Cosby Show in this article? Remember, you will be anonymous. Why is that positive?
Well, counter-stereotypical is the kind of family that is most limited to white people.
So what should that do? You know, what should that do for African Americans as a group?
It should change, like, contribute to the change of stereotypes that, you know, letting other, like, out groups know that there's another side to
right, excellent. The basic argument is that, you know, out-groups, that is, non-African-Americans, watching The Cosby Show should get the idea that African-Americans are not all, you know, name your portrayal, criminals, I'm thinking of Sanford and Son, junk men, blue-collar workers, and so on. It's a counter-stereotypical portrayal, and it should be teaching white Americans that African-Americans can make it, you know, up high as well. So, positive view, counter-stereotypical. Challenge existing views. You know, the idea that if you come to the screen thinking that all African Americans are poor or criminals, when you watch The Cosby Show, that should tell you that that's not the case. Also, you know, the positive view includes the idea that that this wasn't a typical portrayal. This wasn't kind of a groundbreaking portrayal. It stood out. It was kind of a, it's about time argument. It's about time African Americans are portrayed positively. Okay, so there's sort of a relief with it. Well, thank goodness, finally, there's a good portrayal. What about the negative view? Does anybody want to bravely summarize what the argument was against The Cosby Show? Why could this be bad? Yes?
It ignores the cause of discrimination.
Why? What would it do that was bad? What was the argument that The Cosby Show would be doing to white Americans' views of African Americans?
It makes it seem that African Americans
should be at that level. Okay, great. The negative view is that it supports stereotype because. If African Americans can reach that level, those who don't must be lazy. Okay. The argument against The Cosby Show was it's not necessarily realistic. It may lead white viewers to think that if African Americans can all reach the level that the Cosbys have reached, then those who aren't doctors and lawyers must just be lazy. So you have these two, you know, countervailing views of this show. Does anybody have any thoughts on this? I mean, do you think that one of these prevails over the other? Do you agree with one of these more than the other? You know, these microphones can pick up your whispering, too. I'm just kidding. Do you buy one of these arguments more than the other? Yeah.
I guess I would say that I believe them, but I think that it's kind of unfair to criticize the show on those terms because it is a sitcom, and I think that it has positive characteristics, so why should one show have to embody all of these characteristics? Why not say, you know, this show is good because it shows that Black people can reach this height in society, but then we should have other shows that also portray other things.
Okay, I'm gonna carry that comment on because I think it's a very valuable comment here. The question is it fair to jump on one show and to say that the show should embody everything that's needed for a positive portrayal of a group? And I'm going to recall your article that you had to read by Graves. Just some thoughts from the Graves article to try to frame your thoughts about The Cosby Show. The first thought is Graves makes a distinction between fiction and fact. One thing we should think about when we're thinking about all the portrayals, not just one show, but the aggregate of portrayals in a given group, is how are the fictional portrayals constructed and how are the factual ones constructed? I went over that Armstrong, Newendorf, and Brentar article in class where they looked at entertainment versus news. Entertainment television had this positive portrayal of African Americans, whereas news had this negative portrayal. So one thing Graves brings up in kind of a roundabout way is fact may carry more weight first of all. So if I see fictional portrayals of African Americans as ambitious, high achieving, and so on, but all of the factual ones, the news ones, are negative, well, what does that say? You know, it basically says in the real world, blacks are this. In the fake world, they could be like this. So overall, it may cast a negative light on the group. So it's just one thing to keep in mind, fiction versus fact. But the other thing that Graves brings up is the importance of considering the aggregate. And this is, I'm not going to say any names, but this is related to the comment that came over here. Can we even win if we try to make every portrayal perfect? Think back to Clark's notions of recognition and respect. Recognition is the group present at all. Respect is the group, our portrayals of the group, do they span as wide a range of roles as the group occupies in real life? Well, we could probably argue that it's impossible to do that within a given show. You know, we don't have that many characters in a given show. We can't span as wide a range of roles as a group occupies in real life in one show. So maybe we should be looking at the collection of shows, collection of programs does it approach respect? So let me ask you a question then. As somebody who worked in the creative end, as somebody who has a writing background and who's talked to people who write for a living, one thing that writers are told again and again is to write well, write what you know. Write what you know, because you'll be true to it. So, if writers are writing what they know, and what they know turns out to be a very strongly white world, then what might be a solution to these sort of, you know, sporadic portrayals of African Americans or any other group? What might be a solution? What might be a way to get these groups portrayed with more respect?
Yeah. African American
writers. Okay. the answer here was, and there's only one possible answer, but I just want you to think about the possibility of it. Creatives are taught to write what they know. One way to combat this is to get more African-American writers out there, more women writers out there, more Hispanic writers out there, more, you know, and you can go on and on and on, especially dealing with the groups who are underrepresented. You know, it's the same reason that I don't have a content analysis on this, so my number could be wrong, but it seems to me that about 8 out of 10 movies that come out are centered in Los Angeles. Now, you could say, well, that's because it's easier to film there and they don't have to travel and it's cheaper. But part of it as well is that that's the city where most of the people who write this stuff live, and they're writing what they know. Now, do we fault them for writing what they know? You know, do we say you should step out of your comfort zone and try to write about other people? Yeah, we do that. But it goes against a lot of what they've been taught. So the question, the issue that I want to bring up is simply, what do producers do? You know, usually I don't address this, but then I always have a student, an astute student come up and say, well, basically, it's kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't thing. How could anybody write a show and not be seen as racist or sexist? So the question is, what do producers do? You know, one option is to write what they don't know, that is to go against the advice of their craft, but possibly a more viable option is to get women and people of color into industry. And that is happening more and more. It's a slow thing. You'll see these changes over your lifetime. You'll see major changes over your lifetime, but it's not going to happen anytime soon. Okay. Any last comments or questions on portrayals of ethnicity before I move into gender? Okay. I'm going to kick this off with a quote. I'm going to answer him. When a woman is very, very bad, she's awful, but when a man is correspondingly good, he is weird. I like the quote because not only does it bring up the idea of women having to be nice and kind and amicable all the time, but it also brings up what men are expected to be, the male gender role. Men, it seems that men in the media always have to be have a certain measure of ruggedness. Because if they're too good, they're not good, they're weird. That doesn't fit in with what men are supposed to be. Okay. So like gender portrayals, I'm sorry, like ethnicity portrayals, most of the research on gender portrayals is on one group. As with ethnicity, most of the research I covered was on African Americans. Most of the research on gender is on women. But I will cover work on men. Okay. Start with content analysis. Let me give you a little background. You don't have to write this down yet. First of all, it's a generally known thing in the research that there are a lot more men than there are women in the mass media. Typically 3 times as many men as women, and on Saturday morning cartoons, 4 times as many male as female characters. Stats for the Screen Actors Guild for the early 90s showed that almost 3/4 of all acting roles went to men. But keep this in mind when I talk later about mass media and eating disorders and the thin ideal. If women make up more than half the population, but they're competing for 25% of the roles, what does this say about the extremes they have to go to you know, fit the ideal? Okay, women are most often found in comedies, soap operas, family dramas. But what about other types of media? A study by Metelsky in 1985 looked at PBS. Now you think, if you're going to see women
given equal coverage and people of color and so on, you'd see it on PBS, right? This is what you'd think. Well, on PBS, Metelsky found that males outnumbered women 2-1. He split up category of programming. Males outnumbered women 2-1 in each category. Overall, the characters were 72% male. So even PBS is giving more time to male characters. And then this other study by Ziegler and White looked at news. And not women in the news, not the way like Enman looked at African Americans as criminals or as suspects. Ziegler and White were looking at correspondents. Who were the news correspondents? Who were the journalists? Percent of the correspondents were male. So the news story, the news study is really looking at who holds what jobs. So we have almost 90% of all correspondents being male. So we have something on PBS, we have something on news. Now you might ask, what about advertisements? Well, there's a classic book on advertisements, an extensive content analysis by Goffman in 79, and I'll update this for you in a minute. But I want to give you Goffman's categories. Goffman did this extensive content analysis of women in advertising. He's looking at print advertising. And he came up with what he saw as recurrent themes in the way women are portrayed in ads. And I'll show you examples of these themes as I go through. The first one is, he said women are very frequently shown lying down or looking up. What does that indicate? What's that supposed to indicate when a character is lying down or looking up? Yeah. Right, submission, passivity. That's what Goffman argued too. So let me show you examples of this. This is from Goffman's book, okay? This is a little bit old, and I photocopied it right from the book, so it's a little fuzzy. But it's for a suit, a man's suit. You know, there's some sex going on here, obviously. Her skirt's all the way up by her leg, but she's lying down with her hand out to him. He's standing up looking at her. It's kind of hard to figure out what this corresponds to in real life. But anyway, Goffman uses it. It says, some men are suited for games, and some men are just better suited. So it's for a suit. Example, lying down or looking up from Goffman's collection. I found a more modern one by opening up about 2 or 3 women's magazines. This is for cigarettes, obviously. Same basic idea, lying down, looking up. Okay, the next one, smiling. Women are disproportionately shown smiling. According to Goffman, they can be shown smiling at men or just smiling in general. Or smiling for ads where you wouldn't think somebody would necessarily smile. Here's Goffman's example. This is for a man's cologne. The woman is sort of looking approvingly at him, smiling. That was Goffman's. Here's a more recent one that I found. This is an ad for breast augmentation. And she's talking about how it's her choice and all this kind of stuff. Well, it's really about surgery, which you might think would be associated with a picture of somebody serious. But she's even smiling in this one. Okay, My favorite part here is pet peeve, people who pressure you into doing things. So, anyway. Okay, what's next? Goffman said the next characteristic that comes up a lot is that women tend to be portrayed in childlike or whimsical poses. And really, most of this comes out in nonverbal body language. What is childlike or whimsical? Here's Goffman's example. It's obviously an ad for socks, women's socks, but it's the way the feet are crossed in sort of a shy, childlike pose. And here's my more recent example of this. It's for Hanes underwear, but it's the pose, again, that's meant to be sort of childlike. The next one is a little bit more complex. Goffman called it licensed withdrawal. This is what you might look at as expressions of shyness. Goffman also called it women sort of getting permission from the camera end to withdraw themselves emotionally from the action. They're showing expressions of emotion. It may be better understood when I show you images of it. The woman is shown kind of withdrawing from the action, but she's responding to the action, but she's not carrying it forth. And often it comes out in this sort of what appears to be shyness, but it's like withdrawal from the situation. Here's Goffman's example. It's for a hand cream. Who's 30 and who's 22? So supposedly their hands are supposed to, the 30-year-old's hand isn't all wrinkled yet, thanks to the hand cream. But even though it's for hands, you know, they're sort of, they're putting their hands up over their face and they're giggling at something. And they're not actually talking to the viewer. They're not pushing forth the action themselves. A more recent version of this is this ad for nail polish, where again, she's sort of responding to something. She's not looking at the camera. She's withdrawing from the situation by kind of covering up her face. The next one is, Goffman said, gleeful. Women are often shown not just happy or approving, but absolutely gleeful. In situations that wouldn't normally provoke glee. For example, buying a new toaster. I mean, I think that one's kind of funny too. It's kind of hard to see, but here's the new pop-up toaster. And she's, you know, delighted that she's got the pop-up toaster. So this is what Goffman was saying is, you know, glee, not just happiness, but utter glee. And a more recent example is this cigarette ad where, yeah, it looks like everybody's happy. The woman is especially kind of out of her mind happy, you know, popping a Christmas tree in the car. So it's just this expression of glee. Number six, women often shown hiding behind objects. And some of these have kind of a veil-like quality to them. The object she's hiding behind goes right up above her nose and she peeks out from the top of it. Goffman's example is also a cigarette ad. I think this woman looks like a Malcolm McDowell, who's in A Clockwork Orange. You ever see this movie? He's got these false eyelashes that go like that. He's kind of strange looking. But anyway, you know, this is from the mid-70s, and she's peeking out over the cigarettes. So that's an example of hiding behind something. Here's a more recent one. It's JCPenney. This is really veil looking. It's like she's holding it up as a veil, hiding behind it. Okay, and finally, Goffman says, when women and men are shown together, Very frequently, the men are in charge. Now, what does that mean? It can mean leading the woman, doing something to her, or leading the action. So either he's leading her, bringing her someplace, pointing something out to her, teaching her, he's doing something to her and she's receiving that, you know, or he's leading the action and she's kind of watching. His example is, I don't remember what this ad is for. He's got it in the text of his book, but not right under the ad. But it's just the man is telling her, he's informing the woman. And then a more recent version is for, you know, it's meant to be playful, but still, he's doing the action, she's the recipient of the action. Okay, so these are what Goffman came up with as characteristics of advertising with women, print ads. So your question would logically be, okay, so what's going on since 1979? Well, Mian Kang, who used to be a grad student here at the university, here in the Comp Studies Department, did a replication. It was Goffman's Gender Analysis Updated. Oops, sorry. From 1979 through 96, I think, 95, 96. Basically, what she found was no significant change. So she used the same categories. She did a content analysis of print ads. And really, generally no significant change. One thing, just if you're interested, that she found was more women shown in license withdrawal positions, so more likely to be sort of responding emotionally but not to the camera. And then she also had looked, she added an additional coding category, which she called body display, where she's looking at how much skin is shown, basically. Goffman didn't look at this. And Kang showed that, yeah, there's a lot of body display. Okay, so that's just, she updated it, no real significant change. So even up until the early to mid-90s, women are still being portrayed with these same sorts of characteristics. And there's a lot of body, a lot of skin showing as well. Okay, so that's something on advertising, but what about portrayals and entertainment? I'm going to summarize the research for you by domain. One is age. What do content analyses say about women and men's age in portrayals, in entertainment, TV entertainment? Now keep in mind, with age, when you're coding it, you don't actually necessarily have the age of the character, you just have to make a judgment when you look at them. So these are coded by, you know, coders' judgments. You look at somebody, they've got wrinkles all over, they've got wiry gray hair, you'd probably put them maybe above 60, 70, 80. But there's going to be some leeway. So on average, how are females' ages coded compared to males? On average, females 10 years younger than males. Females, on average, appear to be 10 years younger than males. You can probably chalk this up to the overabundance of young, you know, sort of sex object roles. So on average, females younger than males. What about relationship status? You know, you get background of characters when you're learning about a character in an entertainment portrayal. How are they defined? What's their relationship status? Females more likely to be identified as involved. That could mean in a relationship or married. So you can look at this the other way. Men are less likely to be identified by their relationship status. In some way, this makes sense because we still live in a culture where women's titles reflect their relationship status, but men's don't. Miss versus Mrs. A man is Mr. for his entire life. So even in media portrayals, we get this definition of a woman by her relationship status more so than we get for men. We find out that she's married, she's involved, or she's single. With a man, we may just know his job, and they may not give us information about his relationship status. Okay, attire. So what are they wearing? Davis, 1986, slightly older study. What Davis wanted to look at was whether women and men were dressed to a different degree provocatively. So how did Davis define provocatively? Either showing the body shape or showing skin. For example, swimwear, shorts, tight clothing, these are all things that were meant to be provocative. And Davis found that women four times more likely to be dressed provocatively. Now you may expect this to be similar or even stronger now with the way women on primetime programming are dressed. Even in a professional realm, like the Ally McBeal type portrayal or the Melrose Place portrayal where the jacket's there, but the skirt cuts off just at the highest possible point it can cut off. You could call that provocative as well, even though it's professional. So women more likely to be dressed provocatively. And finally, what about occupations? Women are identified as being employed much less often than men. Now again, you can look at this as, you know, we live in a world where producers are conceptualizing women as dependent on men, not likely to be employed. Remember though, you can also look at it as men's characters may be disproportionately shown as being employed. That is, we don't know how to categorize a man unless we know his job in this country. So you have to find out what he does for a living. That is his identity. So men reading this could look at it and go, well, you may think that's a negative portrayal of women, but maybe it's a negative portrayal of men too. You gotta know your job or else you're not a real man unless we know exactly what your job is and we can put you in some mental category. Okay. So these are some general trends in portrayals of women relative to men. Now, what about effects of exposure? And I'm going to talk about a couple studies in more depth here. Study by Morgan. And the study's on television and adolescent sexual stereotypes. Sixth through tenth grade. And the study's longitudinal. Let's see, 2 years, I believe. So Morgan followed 6th through 10th graders for 2 years until they were 8th through 12th grade. Females and males. And what Morgan wanted to see was, Morgan is one of these cultivation researchers, by the way, Michael Morgan. What he wanted to see was whether exposure early on, you know, when they were in 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th grade, predicted their sex role stereotyping 2 years later. So does earlier viewing predict later stereotyping? Let me give you a little more detail here. What they wanted to know was, does earlier TV viewing predict later sexual stereotypes? But also, does earlier sexual stereotyping predict later viewing? This is kind of like these Huseman studies I mentioned to you, where if you're going to follow something longitudinally, you can make a stronger causal argument than if you're just doing cross-sectional, one-time-only research, if you can show that something that happened earlier is related to something that happened later. This is one of our conditions of causality. It's a necessary but insufficient condition, but it's necessary. So, you know, does early violence viewing, is it related to later aggression? But one of the things you got to show is that early aggression is not related to later violence viewing, because that what that indicates is that, in this case with sexual stereotyping, that people with who already had sexual stereotypes just happened to seek out more TV to begin with. And it's not that TV is causing sexual stereotypes. So this is what they've got to look at here. For stereotyping, just to give you an indication of what kind of questions these kids were asked, five questions, and just to give you an example of how explicit these are, they give them true or false questions, and one is true or false. By nature, women are happiest when they are making a home and caring for children. So they're pretty explicit, you know, traditional gender stereotype questions. So what are the findings? Now we're looking at correlations between earlier viewing and later sexism. And this is controlling for earlier sexism. The first is for girls, earlier viewing predicted later sexism, what they would expect. So you know the size of this correlation. R equals 0.14. Significant, it was, but not super huge. In contrast, for boys, earlier sexism predicted later viewing. And here are the correlations, 0.15. For girls, those who watched more TV earlier in the study had higher sexism scores later. But we didn't have the same thing for boys. Early viewing didn't predict later sexism for boys, and for boys, in fact, earlier sexism predicted later viewing. So any ideas on how to explain this difference? Morgan expected. How might you explain the finding with the boys? Just to let you know, I don't have a right answer floating around in my mind. Morgan didn't really know how to explain it. Yeah?
Use this gratification.
How? What would you... So earlier sexism predicts later viewing. That's basically what Morgan would say, you know. Well, if there's a causal link between early sexism and later viewing, since TV tends to be gender traditional, that for boys, already seeing the world in a somewhat sexist way predicts seeking out more TV. All right, but you know, why wouldn't it work that way for girls too? You know, why wouldn't earlier sexism predict later viewing? If they're already more sexist, they should be more willing to see, to be exposed to this content. Morgan used a bunch of different controls, like, you know, socioeconomic status, things like that, that also influence how much you view. But you know, you always want to keep in your mind earlier sexism predicts later viewing for boys. You know, our sexist boys less likely to have friends, and so they end up watching more TV because they're not hanging out with their friends. You know, there are all sorts of possible explanations we don't know. Whereas sexist girls may have a lot of friends because they're fitting in with a desired stereotype for them. You know, the way they defined sexism was sort of anti-female. It wasn't anti-male. It was, you know, women don't have ambition, women can't do certain things. So for a girl to believe in that, she may be agreeable to others. For a boy to believe in that, you know, he may be mean to girls. We don't know. I actually don't know the answer to this, and Morgan doesn't really either. Morgan's saying if there is a relationship, a causal relationship between early sexism and later viewing, it's probably a uses and gratifications kind of explanation. But there could be other ones that we can't tell for certain from this study. Okay, so there's one. And that one's on beliefs. There's another one. The second one I want to mention is Jennings, Geis, and Brown. And this is on behaviors. Don't write this down, but just so you know, the title is The Influence of Television Commercials on Women's Self-Confidence and Independent Judgment. So, how do you measure self-confidence behavior? And how do you measure independent judgment? That is, not going with the crowd. Well, this is this is the challenge that Jennings et al. Had. I'm going to give you the independent variables and the dependent variables. Independent variables. Well, so you could look at it as sex role portrayals, traditional versus non-traditional. Sex role portrayals in commercials, traditional versus non-traditional. Well, what did they do? They took four commercials that were current at the time with traditional sex roles, and they remade them with the sex roles reversed. So the first one was how to handle a hungry man. It was like a TV dinner. They reversed it, so then it was about how to handle a hungry woman, and the man's trying to give her enough food. Wine at a bar, she orders his brand because he knows wine. The sex role reversal was she's the one who knows the wine, and so he orders her brand. Third was stovetop stuffing. She didn't realize that he preferred it over potatoes. The reversal is he didn't realize she preferred it. And then another packaged dinner. The idea is now an exotic meal could be made from a package. So the woman's usually making it for the man. Traditionally, this reversed the roles. So in one condition, they watched the four commercials in their traditional form. In the other condition, they watched the four commercials with the sex roles reversed. Then, here's the interesting part. What were the dependent measures? Dependent variables were two tasks that subjects had to perform. And subjects here are women, by the way. One is rating cartoons for funniness. This is the independent judgment. And I'll explain to you how they did this. First, they had a completely separate group of people rate a bunch of cartoons on how funny they were. And let's say there's a score of 1 to 6. 1 meaning not funny at all, 6 meaning very, very funny. And then they picked out the cartoons that were really seen by this previous group of women as very, very funny, and they picked the ones out that were really seen as not funny at all. So they had some pretty extreme ratings, pretty extreme cartoons. Some that were previously rated as very funny, some not funny at all. Then with the subjects in this study, what they did was had them rate the same cartoons. And then they put up what they call bogus feedback. on the chalkboard in the room. And all that meant was they showed the women what the previous subjects had rated, what their ratings, their mean ratings were. But they lied. With the cartoons that were rated, you know, a 5.5 that were really funny, they gave that, they lied and said that was maybe a 1.5. So it's bogus feedback. These women in the study are thinking, they're reading it, odds are they're going to think it's funny as well if this previous group thought it was funny. But they look up at the board and they see that this previous group rated it only a 1.5. So Jennings et al. Thought that independent judgment should make it more likely. Independence of judgment means you're more likely to not pay attention to these previous ratings and rate it as funny as you think it is. So they gave it a 1.5. That's stupid. I think it's really funny. Lack of this independence should lead the women to go, boy, I think it's funny, but they only gave it a 1.5. I'll rate it lower. Okay, so it's going with the crowd. So that's the first task. The second task is this public speaking task. And by the way, the order of these two is rotated. So half the women did public speaking first and then the cartoons. The other half did the cartoons and then the public speaking. With the public speaking task, the women came into a room and they were told, now we want you to give a 2-minute speech on yourself, which usually strikes fear into the hearts of most people. And they had a couple minutes to prepare, and then they had to go out in front of a group of people and give a 2-minute speech on themselves. Now, the group of people in the audience were instructed to rate each woman on how self-confident she seemed. So if she was shaking all over the place, if she was saying, if she looked like she was about to cry because she was so nervous, they would rate her low on self-confidence. So they're really rating her nonverbals, you know, how confident she seems. And they're blind to condition. That is, they don't know whether the woman speaking saw the traditional ads or the non-traditional ads. They're just rating her perceived self-confidence. So how self-confident she looks. So, what do we find? First thing was, women who viewed the non-traditional ads, first of all, were more independent in their judgment. They were significantly more independent in their judgment. That is, their ratings were closer to the true ratings that the other group had given, which they didn't receive, remember. It's just that these cartoons were generally perceived as funny. So the women in the study reported that they thought that they were generally funny. When they saw the non-traditional ads, when they saw the traditional, they rated them more like the ratings that they saw written up on the board. So there's some evidence that they were a little more independent in their judgment. They rated the cartoons more along the lines of what they really thought and less along the lines of what the other people had supposedly rated them as being. Moreover, they were also perceived as being more self-confident. Now again, keep in mind that, let me give you a scale here for self-confidence. 1 to 5, and the means are 3.38 versus 2.73. So it's not a huge difference, but it's significantly different. The ones who saw the non-traditional ads more self-confident, exuded more self-confidence than the ones who saw the traditional ads. So my point here is that it's a subtle effect, but it's a powerful effect. They're not reporting feeling more self-confident. They're actually judged by a group of raters as more self-confident. So think about, you know, where these kinds of things could be operating in the real world. You go to a job interview. You're sitting in the waiting room, and there are a bunch of magazines out there, and you're pouring through them. doesn't mean that if you're seeing traditional ads, you're going to be less self-confident in your interview than you would be if you saw non-traditional ads. I don't know. But it's something to think about. I mean, this particular study, we can think about ways that it would be externally valid, even though it's an experiment, and it's not necessarily going to be as externally valid as a survey, But there really are situations where exposure to media could affect your behavior in a situation where you're expected to exude self-confidence. Yeah?
As far as this, like, scientists concerned, this thing, you do it, like, the way they do it is that they show you something, and then, like, obviously, like, they find it to you, and you're kind of thinking about it. And isn't that maybe the reason for the results? Is that, like, in general, maybe, like, it doesn't have as great of an effect as, like, right after it's shown to you? It doesn't necessarily affect you, like, constantly, but, like, you know, for 10 to 15 minutes after you see it, it will.
Yeah, I think that's probably the best explanation for the process underlying this is a priming one. They may forget it. And it's short-term. You know, the authors themselves say, this is a short-term effect. You know, odds are women, it's, you know, when you've got, and I'll talk about schemas in a moment, when you've got your worldview built up, four ads may prime, you know, more self-confident or more independent behaviors for a while, but four ads are not likely to change your worldview. So it's not really that these women suddenly went, I am powerful. It's that somehow that was primed in. It's not like they went, I am powerful and I've learned this and now I will always have this with me. It probably lasted a short time and then it went away. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, kind of just that, that they're basing with the results of, like, how this affects women, you know, in general, I would think.
Yeah.
Like something that probably having to do with, like, priming rather than with the long term. Like,
yeah.
Whether or not this affects, like, women on the whole, like, women see themselves as this advantage of the ads.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. We do have to look at this as short term. And it's probably priming that's responsible for it. Now the question is, you know, are there situations where even this kind of short-term effect would actually affect some major event in your life, like how you behaved at, you know, a job interview? It may. Then again, if you're home and you're not going to do anything after this, once those thoughts are gone, it may not have any effect. They're really not. Jennings et al. Really didn't make conclusions like, you know, this has a profound effect on women for a long time. They said, let's be honest here, this is a short-term effect. But if you're exposed to these images regularly throughout the day, maybe they do affect, you know, your behavior. Maybe they affect how other people see you. Just so you know, in the same story or the same study, they later found that exposing women to non-traditional portrayals versus traditional portrayals made them write different essays concerning where they wanted to be in 10 years. And again, you can call this a priming effect. Those who were exposed to the traditional portrayals in the second part of the study were less ambitious about where they were going to be in 10 years. Those exposed to the non-traditional ones wrote things like, you know, I'm going to be the president of a company. You know, they wrote more ambitious things. Now, again, does that mean that these portrayals, you know, 4 minutes of portrayals changed these women's aspirations for what they wanted to do in life? Probably not. It probably was a priming effect that probably went away. But again, the question is, when you're exposed day in and day out through magazines, through television, you know, you're catching a portrayal at the airport while you're waiting for a plane. That counts too. So how does this impact on people's daily lives? That's something that Jennings et al. Aren't able to look at because they just did one study at one point in time. Okay, I don't want to leave men out. So what about men? Well, let me tell you something. There's not a whole lot of research on men. More and more people are getting interested in studying men. But it's just one of these sort of truisms of the research world. People like to study the groups who aren't portrayed so much. So if there are a lot of men, oh, they're fine. We don't need to study them. But now researchers are starting to study men and asking this question that I brought up before. We may think that men are portrayed in respect that is representing all the roles that they occupy in real life, but it's also possible that they're not. You know, you're probably more likely to see a male doctor or lawyer as a character than you are a male postal worker as a character. So what does research say about men? Well, when a group is beginning to be studied, very often the first people who start to describe portrayals of that group aren't social scientists. What often happens is that feminist theorists, cultural theorists, critical studies, American culture studies people will look at portrayals and describe what they think is going on. And then social scientists will come by and say, let's test if this is really happening. So with men, we're really at the stage now where most of the writing about this is done by feminist theorists and cultural theorists. And this guy Strait has written about the myth of masculinity. In beer commercials. Strait argues that the myth of masculinity, that is, what masculinity is supposed to be, is embodied in the beer commercial. So tell me, what do you see in beer commercials? How are men portrayed? What are they usually doing? How are they interacting? Just tell me, how are men portrayed in beer commercials? You've never seen a beer commercial.
Working or watching sports.
Working or watching sports? Right, it's Miller time was the whole idea that once you're off work now, it's time for beer. So working hard, watching sports. Yeah.
Male bonding, which is a bunch of guys sitting together screaming.
Okay, male bonding, it's like mostly all men. When there are women, what's the relationship between the men and the women? Do they show a bunch of gay guys sitting around with their female friends?
Women are serving.
Right, you're laughing because it's so not the typical beer commercial, right? The women are usually maybe scantily clad. It's a very heterosexual kind of image. This is what Strait is arguing. In fact, Strait says that in beer commercials, the whole idea of masculinity revolves around the theme of challenge. Right? Sports challenge. They're playing a game, or they're watching a game, or they're betting against each other somehow. Women challenge. You know, vying for the attention of women, although when you've got the right beer, it's usually not hard. Climbing the corporate ladder. We brought this up as well. And Strait goes so far as to argue that this supports the stereotype of man as hunter. Man as hunter, woman as gatherer. Okay, now Strait's not doing social scientific research to try to quantify this. So this is a different way of looking at it. But he's arguing that beer commercials show this myth of masculinity, man as hunter, man as, you know, meeting some kind of challenge. And if you think about it, it's kind of ironic that that would go along with beer. Because how is beer supposed to help you meet a challenge? You know, if anything in the real world, it holds you back. This brings up one other thing I just wanted to mention. I'm seeing these new Virginia Slims ads for women. You know, they aim the cigarette at women. And they're all about finding your voice. And it's about the eyes are the window to the soul, but the voice shows the spirit. Find your voice. And it's about, you know, sort of stating who you are through this cigarette. But I just think it's funny because people who smoke a lot as they get older can get a really raggedy sounding voice. So again, it's like, what's really the connection between finding your voice and smoking cigarettes? What's the connection between meeting a challenge and drinking beer? If anything, these products would hold you back from that. So this is one view of men. Another view is Garst and Bodenhausen, looking at effects of advertising on men's gender role attitudes. In this study, they had male subjects, they're all males, view either traditional masculine ads or androgynous ads. So in the traditional masculine, the man is either forceful or he's the leader. He's the less emotional one. You know, they were trying to embody the different aspects of stereotypes of men. So traditional masculine versus androgynous. And then they measured these men's sexual attitudes afterward. Now here's something interesting. If you think about that Archie Bunker study, Archie Bunker's bigotry, you might expect that those who already had the most traditional sex roles, that they would come away from seeing the traditional sex role ads feeling especially strongly about traditional sex roles, especially likely to espouse them. Whereas those who were the least traditional initially would come away from the androgynous ads feeling most like, you know, they see the world in androgynous terms. And that they shouldn't come away from the androgynous men should also come away from the traditional sexual ads, you know, rejecting those messages. But what the authors found here, instead that men who were least traditional to begin with, they pre-tested them, changed the most toward traditionalism after viewing traditional ads. Men who initially had been least traditional espoused more traditional attitudes than any other group after exposure to the traditional ads. Although they continued to endorse relatively non-traditional views after exposure to the androgynous ads. So the non-traditional men, the ones who were initially non-traditional, exposure to the androgynous ads, you know, resulted in basically the same views they had to begin with. But exposure to the traditional ads made them actually the most traditional group afterward. So they changed the most. Whereas the men who were initially had been traditional were still relatively traditional, but not as much as the men who had initially been non-traditional. So there's some evidence that the least traditional men were the most sort of changed over by these ads. Now, how might you explain this kind of finding? The authors, incidentally, explained it as gender role advertising teaches non-traditional men to be traditional. It's damaging. You know, it's not. It's damaging because these men who are already, you know, less likely to be gender bigoted, now were, you know, especially gender bigoted. Can you think of any other reason why they would find what they found in this study? What do you think the mechanism is underlying this? Social learning? Cultivation? Priming? What kind of study does this sound like? A social learning study? A priming study? A cultivation study? Yes.
Is this social learning or cultivation?
Why not priming?
Well, I guess, I mean, it depends on how long your effects are like. If they're only feeling this way for 30 minutes, then it looks like priming lasts over the stuff. Maybe something more like cultivation, resonance, or something.
Yeah.
If it was priming, what the manager had the most traditional role? Because they have the most networks already.
This is certainly what you'd expect from a priming perspective. That's right, that's what you'd expect. This doesn't seem to fit in with priming. But you know what? These authors didn't follow up the findings. They only looked at immediate findings right afterward. So we don't actually know. We can't really distinguish if it's social learning or priming. If it's priming, it's going in a different direction than we would expect. If it's social learning, as they argue, it would help if they had had some kind of follow-up measures to see if there was some difference later on.
Yeah,
Because when you measure it right afterward, you know, how do I know the difference in priming or social learning? Priming is not going in the direction I'd expect it to, but you can't go, oh, it's not going in that direction. Let's just scrap our theory and switch to another one. You know, you're not supposed to do that anyway, although sometimes people do. So anyway, kind of hard to explain. Don't really know exactly why this happened. Not consistent with other kinds of priming findings. Garsten Bodenhausen's argument about, you know, these non-traditional men learning to be traditional is just something we're not going to know whether or not that's really what's happening without some follow-up. Okay, so combating negative effects. What are some considerations in this? We're thinking again about this issue that I brought up with ethnic portrayals. What do you do to counteract any possible negative effects? And again, negativity here is a evaluating term. You know, I may be defining gender traditionalism as a negative effect, you may not. So how do we combat effects that enforce gender stereotypes? Well, one issue, one consideration that's very important is schemas. What are schemas? You can define schemas as ways of looking at the world. Prototypes. Schemas have been defined all sorts of different ways. Ways of looking at the world, prototypes, models, you know, what we define as typical. What's typical? So a very common schema exercise is if I say to you, describe a chair. Tell me what a chair has. How do you describe a chair? What has it got? What features does it have? Just shut them out.
Four legs.
What else? Seat. What else? A back. What's it made of? Okay, wood, you know, this is your schema of a chair. Now you know that a throne is also a chair, a stool is also a chair, a lazy boy recliner is also a chair. Even though these things don't have four legs, stool doesn't have a back, they can be made of metal, not wood, but the point is that this four-legged seat with the back made of wood is your schema of a chair. Stereotypes are defined as schemas. Stereotypes are just schemas of people. There's types of schemas. So, we develop schemas very, very young. And the fact that we bring schemas to what we're viewing is going to influence what we take away from what we're viewing. Now, I'll just get through this quickly, but the importance here is that schemas have an impact on memory such that when memory fades, people fill in schema consistent info. When memory fades, people fill in schema consistent info. The last thing, and I promise I'll make this quick, I'll just write Cordua et al. There's one study that demonstrates this with kids. Cordua, McGraw, and Drabman wanted to know how they could kind of reverse very young children, 3 to 5, how they could reverse their stereotypes of men and women. So they showed them a portrayal with a female doctor and a male nurse. Right after the portrayal, when asked what kind of people can be doctors and nurses, right after they watched it, there was this tendency for kids to think that females could be doctors and males could be nurses. Now, Cordua et al. Could have said, wow, look at this. You know, by just showing one counter-stereotypical portrayal, we can take these very young children's views of sex role, occupational stereotypes, and reverse them. But guess what? Later on, the children misremembered what they had seen, so that the male was the doctor and the female was the nurse. That is, when their memory of the video faded, they filled in their memory gaps with schema-consistent information. So they're shown a counter-stereotypical portrayal, but they just remembered it later on as being stereotypical. So this is a main challenge in using media to counteract stereotypes. You've got one portrayal that's counter-stereotypical. One portrayal isn't necessarily going to be able to fight the schema, which comes in and takes over. Okay, remember it's a coffee day, and come down to the front if you need to inform the researchers about what you said.
I have a paper question. I've been trying to